And really enhance the ability to share a single vehicle, for example, rather than having to own one and pick up all those maintenance costs and all the associated costs of using an automobile. So car sharing, definitely part of the mix. Bike sharing, also part of the mix. Public transit was kind of the second highest modal share from our survey. So people said, you know, typically I use cars to get around the city. Transit is kind of a second choice or the second most popular option. And then those, you know, the other mixes of transportation from cycling to walking to car share, ride share, et cetera.
From the survey and the community workshops that you've been hosting, have there been any sort of prevailing opinions or findings that have surprised the team?
Well, I don't know if it was surprising, but I mean, you know, the survey definitely indicates the primacy of gas-powered automobiles as the kind of principal way of getting around Burnaby. So that's probably not going to surprise anyone in the city of Burnaby. But I think what we were kind of curious about, we asked a whole bunch of attitudinal questions to really figure out, like, how are people making discrete choices around how they get around? And what are the kind of levers that we could potentially pull on to encourage people to take, you know, more sustainable mobility options and make that a reality? And so some of the things that we're hearing right now from community members, in addition to findings from the survey, is that cost is obviously a really significant pressure, right? So the higher the price of fuel, the less likely people are to drive, the higher co the cost of maintenance, the less likely people are to drive. But in the same breath, we're also hearing that transit is really expensive across Metro Vancouver. And so we're trying to, you know, play around and hear from people, you know, what would it mean for us to offer free transit? What would that cost look like? How would that actually encourage or shift mode share to transit? Is there kind of like an upper limit or a lower limit to transit pricing that would encourage the most number of people in Burnaby to actually access and utilize that particular transportation? Similarly, we're hearing a lot of things around infrastructure development, right? Even is things as simple as like the lack of covered bus shelters is a real disincentive to people taking the bus. In addition to route regularity, right? There's a couple of kind of things where people have said, well, what if we kind of developed a rapid bus system between Metrotown and Lougheed, for example, and really tried to encourage people to move sustainably across the city and move quickly. So, you know, at its core, Danny, this project is really, you know, it's asking the question, how do we make the sustainable choice, the most affordable choice, and the most efficient choice for people across the city of Burnaby? How do we achieve that in ways that people who reside and live and work and play and commute through Burnaby, how do we do that in a way that actually brings them along and encourages them to make that choice?
You know, I attended one of these workshops last week in Metrotown, and I think one of the prevailing things I heard is that the biggest barrier is that there is still the perception that whether it's biking or public transit, a personal vehicle is always going to be the fastest choice when it comes to getting around. Has this project sort of identified not just, you know, how to sort of reverse that thinking, but also to address that, because, you know, in a lot of cases, that is the case within Metro Vancouver.
Yeah, it's definitely a prevailing opinion, right? That this idea that cars are going to be they're going to give me the most flexibility and it's going to be the easiest way for me to get around the city. I think what we're also hearing in those workshops is that people are actually making some really intentional decisions around about how they move around, and it really depends on what their location is and what the purpose of travel is. So we know from our survey results, for example, that people are much more likely to drive if there's going to be a perception of them having to carry heavy things like groceries, for example, right? The people are much less likely to take transit, even if it's the cheaper option and, you know, requires no parking and no stress and anxiety around any of that. Carrying those heavy grocery bags up an escalator and onto the train and then all the way home might be enough of a barrier to encourage car ownership. We're also hearing from people that, you know, depending on where they're going, certain disincentives like limited parking, for example, or a prohibitive cost of parking is actually encouraging people onto transit and onto SkyTrains, right? So those are some of those levers, again, that we're trying to figure out what is the right balance in terms of costing that encourages people to shift towards that more sustainable option. And in the case of other forms of micromobility, what are the types of infrastructure and where would people actually like to see that infrastructure located on their city? So one of the big barriers that we've heard around active transportation, for example, in Burnaby, is that we know it tends to be a much younger group of predominantly well-educated men who cycle across the city of Burnaby. We kind of found that's the case across a lot of different neighborhoods. The question really becomes, okay, well, we know that east-west transportation on bike is pretty good. We also know that Burnaby is pretty hilly, right? So how are we making making intentional decisions around where we locate that cycling infrastructure to make it as low barrier as possible. And similarly, what are the right kind of north-south routes to enhance connectivity of Burnaby's existing cycling infrastructure? Because we know that that's a huge barrier to people biking. And the number of times I heard in the last week, you know, I'm on my bike and then I get really frustrated because my bike lane just ends and it spits me out into traffic and there is no real sense of connectivity or sense of a network. That's true not only just when we think about cycling, but when we ask the question, okay, well, if we were biking, how do we make our transportation system in Burnaby as connected as possible across modes, right? So maybe we can't bike the entire way to a destination, but maybe it's about that first and last mile where we might bike to a particular location and that connectivity is actually encouraging connection through other forms of transportation like transit, car sharing, and so on and so forth.
Okay, I think I have one more question to ask. And that would be for those now just hearing about this research project that want to get their voices out there, want to get involved, want to contribute. How can they best do that?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways. So first and foremost, we're hosting a series of workshops across the city right now. And there's a mix of online and in-person workshops. I'd encourage people to check out, if they Google SFU Create, Decarbonizing Transit, you'll find Vahid Hosseini, who's the nominated principal applicant. We have a website on the web for SFU. All of the links for our workshops are listed there. So please, I would encourage your listeners to register, come out, share your opinion with us. We will be hosting other workshops as well in the future. This is just kind of our first kick at the can, but you'll also see us out in the community this summer. We've had lots of invitations from other organizations to come to block parties and community fairs and host a booth and engage people. So we're hoping to have a presence in the community this summer at public events. Beyond that, you can reach out to any of the members of our team, and it would certainly encourage your readership when you find Vahid's website to reach out. If you can't attend those workshops, we're always happy to hear from folks and receive your big, bright ideas by email.
Once again, that was our conversation on the Alternative Urban Transportation Decarbonization Research Project based in Burnaby with Chris Busey, a co-principal investigator with the project, as well as an assistant professor of health sciences at Simon Fraser University. To learn more about the project, as well as the team involved, go to sfu.ca's Create page and look for the project titled Decarbonizing Communities on Road Transportation. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative.
Hello there. It's time for Gardening with Embark. And joining us in the studio is our gardening expert, Pablo Vimas from Embark Sustainability.
Hello. Nice to be here.
We are week 23.
Correct. Yes.
Moving deep into the growing season.
That's right.
And in a moment, we're going to talk about all the stuff that's We're getting to actually taste and stuff that's coming up.
Correct. So as the weather warms up, most of our spring crops start to be ready for harvesting before they start to go to flower. So yes, we are in a busy season harvesting our spring crops and as well busy planting the summer crops.
Right. But we're also dealing with all this fast-changing weather. You know, very hot, then it's cold, and we had some real torrential rain recently. And
yes, it has been a challenge in the garden. Some of the vegetables, such as beets, they have not grown as expected. Mm-hmm. There is tanned, means that they germinated and just staying in a small stage. And so that's happening. And the other crops, well, they are managing with this changing weather. Mm-hmm. I think in the coming weeks, we are going to have high temperatures, which is time to start harvesting our spring crops.
And great. What do we need to think about when we're harvesting our crops? Well, first off, what are the ones we're harvesting? What are the plants that are coming ready to be harvested?
Okay, so the ones that are coming already are spinach. If depending on the variety, some of them don't like hot weather. So yeah. Spinach, we have arugula.
So does that mean we want to kind of get them out before?
Before they go to flower or they get too bitter to eat.
Yeah.
So we have spinach, we have arugula, and then we have lettuce, broccoli is ready. Onions, the spring onions that we have planted as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and radishes. they are ready to come up and be harvested.
Yep.
So when we harvest, we tend to split our crops in two groups, above ground and below ground. And we keep it separately. And when we harvest separately, not at the same time. That is in order to prevent any contamination. And as well, when we harvest, we wash our hands. For instance, we always harvest leaves first, everything above ground first.
Yeah.
This is because when we pull a radish or a beet or a carrot, soil comes up with the root.
Yeah.
So if you shake it and you have lettuces around you, you're making all your surroundings dirty.
Right.
And then it leads to do an extra washing.
Yeah.
So at the same time, we are thinking we need to be food safety first, and at the same time, we don't need to waste water and reduce extra work and prevent contamination. So it's all
just simple little things that make a big difference.
So let's say we are having have a plot with lettuces and radishes and carrot. We will pick the leaves of lettuce first.
Yeah.
So you will pick the leaves. It is losing leaves. You will push the leaves down. It will break close to the stem. And you collect them, and then you will collect in a container that has been is being only used for harvesting. This container has to be clean, and only comes to the garden for harvesting.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we say, "Oh, I need to harvest," and you just whatever container is in the garden, and they say, "Oh, it just rinse it and wash it." But those containers have been used for either carrying manure. Carrying fertilizer, weeding, just a simple rinse and washing doesn't do the trick. So you need to have a container that is only for harvesting.
Yeah, I guess we, you know, even though we're in the garden, we have to remember that it's food still.
Yes.
You know, you wouldn't serve food on a dirty plate, and maybe you shouldn't collect your food from the garden on a dirty basket.
In a dirty basket, yes. Yes, it's food. And so we will wash our hands. If you've been working in the garden, wash your hands before, prior harvesting. And then you collect all your leaves. And leaves, usually, I tend to do a rings to cool the temperature down of these leaves, because the leaves still keep breathing in and out. So we need to cool them off a bit. We use water at temperature, a room temperature of the water that is available. And the second rinse will be water a bit cooler than the previous one. And then we try to bring the harvest indoors or put in the shade.
Yeah.
When I'm in the garden, I'm harvesting, I put a bit of water in my container with the leaves to keep it cool.
Yeah. And that will help them last longer too?
It helps to last longer. They don't wilt faster and until you can get home. So it's just try to cool the leaves a bit more and preventing the dehydration. So otherwise, eating a lettuce that is all wilted is not as nice as eating a crunchy lettuce.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So the next, once I harvest the leaves, we move to the roots.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just pull the plant. If it's carrots or carrots, what we tend to do is to push the carrot first down to break the roots. Mm-hmm. So you push it down and later you pull it up.
Right.
And before harvesting the carrots, we check for the carrot shoulder. So you clean the soil around the carrot top and you will see how thick the carrot is from the top. And if it's too little one, you just leave it for the next week. If it's a decent size, you will just push it down and pull it up.
Yeah.
And then whatever soil comes, you just clean with the hand, and then it goes in the container, a different container, and so on. With the radishes, it's very easy. Radishes, you just can see how big they are. You just pull, clean the soil in the container.
Mm-hmm.
Beets, usually they grow above ground. There's a small tip of roots that in the ground, but the root is above ground.
Yeah.
Again, just pull it and then put in the container. We wash all our root vegetables, as I mentioned, and then you will trim the tops.
Yeah.
For instance, people don't like the tops of the carrots, so you tend to trim them before bringing home, because unless you have a rabbit or a hamster that's interested or in eating those tops, but if you can leave the tops in the garden, but don't cut too close to the root, so leave at least 1 inch of tops above the roots.
Yeah.
So the same with the radishes, carrots, beets, the same. beets, the leaves of beets can be eaten. We can eat those as well. So yeah, it's all depending how much we can consume from our vegetables.
Right.
So everything washed with clean water as well.
Yep.
We are talking about urban farming. We very much use tap water.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we tend to as well think, oh, I will save. So I wash my vegetables with one water, and with the same water, I will wash my next vegetables. Like, better use clean water every time that you're doing your washing. Yeah.
Great.
And when we are harvesting fruits, because at the moment we have peas coming.
Okay.
Yes, so we have delicious peas. So again, we have to use our two hands. One hand will hold the vine, and the other hand will pull the pot. With fruits are each a bit more easier. Make sure that the water is not
because they're above ground. They're not. On the ground.
They're above ground, so it's much easier. They hardly get dirt. Unless they drop, and use clean water to wash them. Sometimes I just wait to get home because they are fruits; they will stand. That's very much what we are at the moment harvesting. And if we are using tools for like knives, we should try to avoid that the knife that we are using to cut things touch the soil.
Right.
So we always are two fingers above the ground doing any cuttings.
Right.
Yeah, when we are with leaves. Yeah. Just to prevent, again, that could be that you have added manure, you have added organic fertilizer, and you don't want that knife touching the soil and transferring that soil or that product into your vegetables.
Once people get their harvest home, are there any tips for looking after it?
Well, yeah. So the you will wash very well, and then you will put in a container. Leaves usually do very well with a bit of paper towel in a container at the bottom, and you top you put your leaves.
Right.
So in order to keep it nice and moist, so not too dry. For leaves, that's for leaves. For roots, just wash them, and they go straight in the refrigerator. When I have herbs, lots of cilantro, I love cilantro. So what I do is just putting a Ziploc bag and in the freezer, because it's easier to take a bit, break the frosting leaves and use in your salads, yeah.
Great. So the learning gardens here that Embark is running, you guys are going to be generating a fair bit of produce.
What
are you guys going to be dealing with it?
Yeah,
sometimes it's more than Embark can take.
Correct. So we've been harvesting the last 3 weeks. We've been harvesting, and we've been sharing all this produce with the food rescue.
Mm-hmm.
So every Thursday we have the food rescue running in the subway hall, and between 1 and 2:30, and all the produce is shared with the community.
And so people are on campus; they can drop by Thursday 1 o'clock, right? And pick up some fresh greens.
Correct. So today, for instance, we will be harvesting broccolis that are ready, and as well we have our French sorrel, which is a perennial, and just leaves keep coming. So we keep harvesting. Yeah. So bit by bit, we are harvesting our spring crops and setting summer crops.
Excellent. Well, very exciting this time of year when all the hard work is starting to pay off.
Correct. Yes. Because we have started early in the season, if you recall, we start together with the program very early in March. So, yes, we're happy to have the time to harvest and to share with the community.
Excellent. Nice when all the hard work pays off. Tell us more about how to find out more about Embark.
Yeah, Embark is a non-profit society managed and led by students. We are based in the Student Union building, so you are welcome to come and visit us. You can visit our website at embarksustainability.org or our social channels, hashtag embarksustainability.
And you can, if you're a student at SFU, you can find out from the website about how you can get involved with the Learning Gardens. And you'll meet Pablo and learn a whole lot.
Yes, absolutely. You're welcome to join us. We have two main streams. One is called Food Justice, which includes gardening.
This audio has been updated to correct an error in the original post. The portion of the audio that is being emceed is being voiced by Jason Krauskopf, the board chair of the Smithers Skate Park Society, and not Everett Tetz of New Line. Everett Tetz emceed the later portion of the event. This is CICK News. Today on CICK News, I was at the skate park on Thursday, May 29th for a very special skate demo, and I caught up with the Smithers Skate Park Society board member, Sarah Fitzmaurice, to find out just how this amazing event happened.
I'm Sarah Fitzmaurice, and I'm one of the fundraisers for the Smithers Skate Park Society.
How did you get Tony Hawk and his crew to come to Smithers?
So we have some local foundations here in Smithers that have contributed to different phases of the skate park expansion. And through those foundations, we were introduced to Power to Give, which is a foundation on Vancouver Island. And so through that connection, we met the people involved in the Tony Hawk Foundation and also the Mark McMorris Foundation. I believe their foundations do projects together. And so that's really how the introduction was made. And back in January, we did a call with all the different stakeholders and things went from there.
Okay. And so who was involved with the latest extension?
It's a partnership between the Smithers Skate Park Society, the Town of Smithers, and the Office of the Wet'suwet'en Youth Moody, or Youth Leadership. And so for this phase three, we received a contribution from Power to Give, but also we've received contributions from a lot of different individuals and companies in Smithers.
What were some of the reactions that you saw there or that you heard that really just cemented your belief that Smithers deserves a skate park like this and for an international legend to show up and skate on it?
Just the crowd reaction. They were just so excited, so honored. Tony really took the time to connect with youth, especially the singers and dancers who came from Wet'suwet'en. We really wanted to make sure that they had an audience, and they just sang beautifully and provided such an amazing welcome for the event. I witnessed a kid named Ian Sear, who makes miniature skateboards, like that are all the kind of the Birdhouse brand coloring, and he presented that to Tony, who was really touched by that. And I wanted to mention that Tony and his crew showed up at the skate park the day before and borrowed the kids' skateboards that were there and just skated the park. And to see a 12-year-old boy crying because he's so overwhelmed, it was just so beautiful.
Do you know how many people? I was guessing maybe 1,700, but do you know or have a guess of how many people showed up on Thursday?
We don't. We thought there would be 300, and there were definitely over 1,000.
Yeah, I'd say. I was looking and I thought comfortably there's probably about 1,500 people here, it seemed.
Yeah, Tony tried to give us some guidelines about crowd control and barriers and things like that, because we'd never done an event like this. And originally we thought, oh, maybe he doesn't know that Smithers is a town of 5,000 with one flight in a day. But boy, were we ever wrong.
Since becoming a nonprofit in 2020, dedicated volunteers and partners have worked tirelessly to make this project possible. This skate park is a testament to community collaboration with support from the Town of Smithers and the Office of the Wet'suwet'en Youth Leadership Program, or Moody. The park offers low-barrier, unstructured play for youth, an affordable alternative to organized sports. The Smithers Skate Park Society are now fundraising for Phase 4, which includes a pump track, permanent washrooms, and a picnic area, aiming to break ground in 2026.
Okay, guys, so the way today's going to work is we are going to have some surprise guests show up very shortly to do a demo for you. Yeah!
That is the voice of Jason Krauskopf, the board chair of the Smithers Skate Park Society, who emceed the event that you were either at or you heard about on the news and social media last week when Tony Hawk, Grayson Fletcher, and Lizzie Armanto, who are all professional skateboarders, arrived at the Smithers Skate Park to a crowd of over 1,000 people to demo the latest expansion of the Smithers Skate Park. They were welcomed by Kayla Mitchell and the Ekahia Hosley Drummers to a very excitable crowd.
I'm so honored to be here, and I just want to introduce myself. I'm Kayla. I'm Deputy Chief of Wet'suwet'en First Nation, and I'm here today to introduce to you some of our hereditary leaders. So although I'm the leader of our village in Wet'suwet'en over there, this territory belongs to our stewards of the land. And so if we want to give a really warm welcome to our Tsapaizek Tsawit, who has been caretaking this land for a long time. Miss Sai, let's give it up for Tsawit! Woo!
Before the main event, young skateboarders were given lessons by skate park volunteers for a learn to skate afternoon in the park for youth from ages 7 to 13. What's your name?
My name is Patrick.
Okay, and so you're volunteering for this event, Learn to Skate, but you're also here for this big demo. Is this the turnout that you expected?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, it's everybody's heard about it. Big stars coming in, so it's a big thing for Smithers.
Yeah. How did the Learn to Skate go today? I mean, I still see lots of little people out there on their skateboards, but how did it go today?
It actually went really well. Like, we saw lots of improvements in a lot of the kids, and a lot of them also got free gear, so that'll probably encourage them to do some more.
For sure. Thank you very much, Patrick.
Yeah, thank you.
Rob Nisbet.
Okay. So, were you here for the Learn to Skate day so far?
Yeah.
What were some of the skills that were being taught today at Learn to Skate?
We learned how to push, how to stand on a board, how to just get your balance, how to drop in on a little ramp. And yeah, they all got all those maneuvers pretty quickly.
Yeah. How do you think of the skate parks being received ever since it was built? And were you involved in...
Yeah, I mean, I grew up skateboarding and I love the skate park. And the fact that we got the new park, I mean, it's like, it just puts so much more creativity in, back into someone like me who's like almost 50. And watching the younger kids just shred the park is super fun to do.
Yeah.
I was involved. I built the new shelter here. So.
Oh, nice. Oh,
yeah, and just some of the new concrete work in the around the shelter. And the B4B bank, of course, was a beautiful idea that we got to bring to a reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess lastly, do the kids know, like, how excited are they about the superstars?
Coming to the skate park last few days just to come skate, just everybody's just like, so is it true? And I'm just like, I don't know. And like, I had a hard time keeping it a secret, honestly, because yeah, I just think it's so cool that not only we get a new park, but we get like this interest sort of, you know, from beyond Smithers borders, and Terrace is here and a bunch of Prince George kids. And yeah, like, it's really cool that this event is turning out as big as it is, and just seeing a lot of kids just like, they don't want to get off their skateboards.
Yeah.
It's rad.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, fam.
It looks like a few trucks have just pulled up. And we're going to find out if those rumors are actually true.
Among the throngs of kids skating, their parents watching, and people of all ages waiting, all of a sudden, with very little pomp and circumstance, Tony arrived.
Are you guys excited for that? Yeah! Can you guys stand at the bottom of the hill? All right, we got to give them a little bit of space. So we're going to start with our traditional welcome. Come on up, ladies.
Hi, Saifoldi, Ramona. I'm from the Lipsiliu clan, and we are here to help welcome the expansion of the park. We're Akaya Hosley, which means bringing it back to life. And we are going to start off with honoring the territory that we're on. This is unceded territory of the Wet'suwet'en, and we are going to start off with a Gidimdan Kaskan song, which means small bear.
Bringing these skaters to Smithers is a massive boon to the skate park and all of the partners involved. Sarah shared with me a part of their visit that struck me as unique to the Wet'suwet'en territory that Smithers resides on, and to consider the history of the land that we play on.
The morning of the 29th, I should mention in terms of the partnership with Kayla and the Office of Wet'suwet'en Youth, and youth from Wet'suwet'en, really her team came up with this, a learning on the land session. From 10 to 12, we took the athletes up to the lookout, which is on the way up the Hudson Bay Mountain. And she and her team and her youth did a learning on the land session. They taught the group Wet'suwet'en words. They had maps of the territory, and they took us through a few different ceremonies, and it was incredible. They did drumming, skating, and I could see that the athletes, many of them, Tony included, had never experienced anything like that before. They talked about the murdered and missing Indigenous women, and also why that lookout was important in terms of the town's history. It was just phenomenal. People were crying. It really moved people. And
unfortunately, we are out of time. Democracy Now! Will be up in just a few minutes. Thanks to CICKA Radio in Smithers for that report and the Local Journalism Initiative. Here comes